Oh,
Oh no, it's being recorded.
that was every time I'd have staff meetings at like one of the universities, that was always like, oh, bring it down. I used to come up to Sacramento probably a couple times a year, flying in there to go to Stockton. I had some friends out there, so frequented your old town
Yeah,
walk. It was a cool little area, I
it
guess.
is a cool little area, Old Town Sac.
Yeah.
I haven't done the underground. There's an underground tour in Old Town Sac now, where because the old street level is quite a bit lower, and so now actually the street level of Old Town Sac is a little bit higher now. So there's a whole
Interesting.
underground area there. So.
I love that kind of stuff. There's like if you ever go to Tombstone, Arizona, there's actually a hidden like underground tour that you can take down there. Through all the
That
ghosts
sounds like fun.
and you have to find the right person to ask, but yeah, there's an underground tour there.
Well, we should begin. So you had a little bio of yourself, but why don't you tell me, why don't you go ahead and tell me a little bit about yourself?
I'm kind of like stream of consciousness sometimes, so I apologize in advance. A little
Did
bit of
you have to
background.
apologize for that on this channel?
Yeah, well, fair enough. Well, a little bit of background on me. My parents were kind of like part of the like Jesus hippie movement, I guess, like in the 70s. My mom was deeply involved in missions. She spent time in Iran before the Shah fell. She spent time in Pakistan, all that kind of stuff. My dad was a DTS, that is a Dallas Theological Seminary graduate. So he was like that whole scene. He was a pastor when I was born. And my dad was a church planter. He got burned doing that up in Washington. I was born up there, but we moved down to Arizona pretty soon after that. I grew up in a household where we didn't have television. The only things I watched were like Bible cartoons. Your viewers might not be familiar with Superbook or the Hanna-Barbera Bible Adventures. My first Bible was a comic book Bible. I was deeply immersed in like kind of what would you call like the
Bible
evangelical
bookstore
Christian.
evangelical kitsch.
The social imaginary of evangelical Bible bookstore.
Wow. Wow.
And
Very,
so
very Western United States, too. I
yeah,
mean,
oh yeah, totally. I
yeah.
didn't know that at the time, but later on, of course, what's that book on evangelicalism that came out a few years ago? I can't remember her name. It was a big book, though.
Oh, Worthen? Apostles of Reason?
No,
Molly
no, it was
Worthen?
just called evangelicalism.
Oh,
I can't
okay.
remember. It was a popular book. Even Al Mohler interviewed this author. I can't, but I remember I was reading through that book and I'm like, she's like talking about the history of Western fundamentalism. I'm like, oh man, that's like
That's me.
it's like all the people my parents were talking about. My mom, though, it's kind of weird. My mom was also very involved, like with civil rights. And my dad was, a Baptist preacher. My mom did not want to be part of the Southern Baptist Convention, though, because she grew up in the South and knew about that whole relationship. So we were
Yeah,
actually
yeah.
part of the Conservative Baptist Association, is what my dad was with. So we went out to Payson. Arizona, which is a small kind of, at the time it was like, they didn't have nothing. They just had a grocery store just open up when I was out there. And so my dad was minister, trying to raise a family. I think he was getting like $10,000 a year or something like that, trying to raise a family out in the small town rural community. And at some point, they had a guest speaker come in and they were like speaking, I don't know, they were doing all the crazy stuff. And my dad was like, everybody loved it. My dad's like, oh, I can't do this. And so he went on a walk that night and decided he was going to apply for law school. And so he did the opposite. Most people, they're lawyers and then feel bad and become pastors. He was a pastor, felt bad and became a lawyer. And so we moved down. He went to law school down in Tucson. So we moved down there and lived down there for a long time. Spent I was lived in a pretty like diverse cultural context. I was My mom tried to get me to enroll in a, they have magnet schools, is what they call them down there. It was like kind of these places where they let you kind of like explore sciences and arts a little bit more in a more focused manner. They wouldn't let me go there because I offset my school's demographic there. I was like, I was like the white guy there, the token white guy at my school. So they wouldn't let me leave. But so went down to Tucson, lived there for quite some time. My dad was a lawyer there. We moved up to the Phoenix area. I can remember being in about fourth grade and thinking to myself, as I was looking at all the church kids my parents were making me hang out with, thinking to myself that this church stuff is kind of malarkey, right? I can remember, like, I was really into UFOs, aliens. When I was a kid, I was a really strange kid. I watched a lot of X-Files as a child. I believed in ghosts, and like I thought Bigfoot, I thought the truth was out there, Paul.
The truth is out there.
And so my first book report was on a book about UFO abductions I ever wrote. And so but I can remember thinking that church is kind of malarkey. I can remember sitting down with like this homeschool Christian kid at my house. We're talking about aliens, and he goes, well, aliens don't exist because they're not in the Bible. And I said, what are you, an idiot? Cars aren't in the Bible either. Do you believe in them? And that was my defense. And so, that kind of, from about third grade to through middle school, in middle school, I became like a skater, punk rocker, and I was convinced church had nothing to offer me. Yeah. And then at some point they hired some like, what would you call it? Like a youth pastor, I guess. He had like blue hair. He was punk rocker, skater. He liked all the things I liked and liked all the music I liked. And I was like, that's how they get you in evangelicalism. They're like, they get the cool guy who's like, guys, Jesus is awesome. And so he kind of suckered me in and started playing in the worship band there. I was what I call a tooth and nail Christian. Tooth and Nail was a record label, a Christian punk record label. I don't know if it's still operating, it probably is. But I was a tooth and nail Christian. So I was like, well, these cool skater guys who are punk rockers are Christians, so there must be something there. So I was a very, as you can imagine, liberal kind of like evangelical. I was the guy who was like, supporting gay rights issues before people were really talking about that in church context. Yep. I was very much attuned to how white our congregation was.
Yep.
And I was also like really hostile towards like nationalism. This was like early Bush years. So yep. I was really hostile towards, the kind of like, well,
Iraq war.
I was really like, really hostile towards that kind of stuff. And I can remember being in high school and sitting around in class with all of like my evangelical youth group friends. And they're sitting there saying, we just got to support our president. And I would get into these big heated debates with them in the middle of history class. My history teacher would allow it because she was a Kennedy Democrat, right? So she was like, good. So that was kind of my background. Through high school, that was kind of my story. I discovered, I was really into music, really into performance, all these kinds of things. I started helping when I graduated high school. I helped out with our youth group as kind of like, assisting the youth pastor. At some point, though, I had just like one too many church camps. I actually went to Hume Lake a lot. You might be familiar with Hume Lake.
Yeah.
I went there a lot as a counselor. And I just remember once sitting around a room, everybody was joking about what they called the coming down the mountain experience. And it was when students, they'd have a big high, spiritual high up there, and then they would come down the mountain to real life. And they would just fall, their faith would kind of fall apart. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, this happens, and you're sitting around joking about it. And I was like, that's it, I'm done. Like, I'm just like so done with this. I don't know why that was the straw, but like, I mean, in the meantime, in college, I discovered things like I read the Bhagavad Gita, the Tao Te Ching. I discovered something called the Gospel of Thomas, and I was like, WTF, church? Why didn't you tell me about this? I read Waiting for Godot, and I can remember reading Waiting for Godot. You've probably read the play. I don't know. I should assume, but that moment where they're talking about the differences in the crucifixion scenes and how only one mentions that there was this thief who had a change of heart at the cross. I was like flabbergasted. I was like, how did I not notice this? It's like I stop in the middle of the play, I throw that down, and I read all four of the Gospels, the crucifixion scenes. I'm like, oh my God. I go into church the next
Sunday. The truth is out there and you've been
hoodwinked. I go to church the next Sunday. I'm trying to tell people about this and they're just like totally disinterested. And I was like, oh, okay. And so, I was like, I started getting hard into the documentary hypothesis. I started reading all of the apocryphal canonical stuff. I read a book called Jesus by, oh God, what was the guy's name? I can't remember now off the top of my head, but a historical study of Jesus where I discovered Q source and all this kind of stuff. And this was like, I was going to community college at the time. They weren't talking about any of that crap at community college. I was just like, I did a hard dive into it. I was really into literature. I read Harold Bloom's The American Religion, which like I discovered Gnosticism and blew my mind about the Southern Baptist Convention, about how like Gnostic they are. And like, so I started reading all this stuff, Elaine Pagels and all this kind of thing. And that was around 1819. And so from 1819, I was kind of like, I went to my youth pastor and told him, I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. Yep. And walked away again. I got really into film during that time, really started studying Joseph Campbell, Carl Jung, the archetypes and all these kinds of things. I got really deeply interested in that, especially his surveys of religion, because I also thought, like, I began to think that religion was a helpful way of like understanding human narrative, because I thought religions were true in the way that like Shakespeare was true. It spoke about like something like, you know, there was like a mythical psychological core underlying it all. And I was like, this is why these stories kind of resonate with humans. And so I want to know how to access this so I can write successful screenplays, right? I'm the perfect like commodity, like, you know, whatever. But, you know, Karl Marx would, you know, cringe or say, see, told you so. but so I got really involved in that. I moved to Los Angeles at some point. I wrote some scripts, nothing anybody would ever hear of. The other thing that you should know about me is I've always been really suspicious of social media and all of these things. I have a flip phone still. I haven't gone on Facebook since 2012, probably. And so that's like, you know, I'm very suspicious. I don't have a IMDb. I try to, if there is anything about me on IMDb, it's because other people put it there, not because I've put it there, kind of type of thing. I did some short film work. I helped, you know, others, you know, other people writing their stuff. I acted in a few like music videos, but it was kind of like.
Is there acting in music videos? I remember for them from the 80s. What acting there was in music videos in the 80s was really bad.
Oh my gosh. I can remember like one time I was a silhouette. Another time I had a like a zebra head on and I was smoking a cigar. But Paul, I mean, it's so sad. My heart breaks for like the city of dreams, the city of angels, right? It's like, man, there were some people I worked with who had been doing it for like 40 years and they were still doing stuff like this was non-union work that they were doing. And they still thought they were going to make their break. And you're sitting there and it's just like, it's a city of these broken dreams, man. It's like, that's such a cliche, right? But it's like, yeah, it's
true.
At a certain level, you just like, oh man. And nobody talked about the job that they actually had, which is what they pay, how they paid their rent. They all talked about like, what they were aspiring to be, right? And it was like taboo to ask what you actually did. but like, yeah, so there were people who thought they were really great actors and who were involved in these things. And yeah, so there was acting, but yeah, you know, it's that level. So I was out there for a little bit. I got really burned out on that city, got really jaded. I wasn't even living in the city. I wasn't in North Hollywood or anything like that. I was out in Whittier, California, because I was like, God, if I have to live in LA, I'm at least going to live in a town that feels like a small town. So I got burned out, jaded out there a little bit. During that time, I was still doing my music. I ended up coming back out to the Phoenix area. I was working on music out there with a recording partner, doing some performances. And then like a series of bizarre events happened in my life where, I don't know, I look at it now as like, this is going to make me sound like a tutti-frutti religious guy, I guess, but it was like the movements of the Holy Spirit working in my life. It was like, I was chasing all these dreams and fantasies. I'm not even kidding. I don't know if you heard about that guy who wrote a poem that for a buried treasure somewhere. Did you hear about this rich guy like years ago who he wrote a poem that was supposed to, he had all these like all this gold that he was burying somewhere. And he wrote a poem that was supposed to give you the clues to where it was. It was somewhere basically in the Rocky Mountains.
Oh, I heard something about this.
Forrest Fenn, I think was his name.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding you. Me and my brother had like, we had like put together this elaborate plan to go dig for buried gold. one summer. It was so ridiculous. So I was looking for Barry Gold playing music around town, right? I was looking for Barry Gold, you know, trying to write my screenplays and make it in Hollywood. And then I was looking for actual buried treasure. A series of circumstances happened. I had some grandparents pass away, and there's nothing like that shakes you, like having grandparents pass away within 24 hours of one another, and then having to go and like sift through the relics, the relics of their life, right? Something happened in that process, and I started really like kind of rethinking like what I had been doing with my life. Now, I didn't do anything like, you know, profound necessarily. I decided I was going to finish going to college. And for some reason, I decided to make this really genius decision of going studying religion in college. So during my film time, I had still been connected to religion. I had worked a lot studying specifically Navajo religious practice and Navajo witchcraft specifically, which is like, that would be a whole, you know, series of hours right there. So I don't know if I want to get into that, but I spent a lot of time interviewing people, reading transcripts and reports of things. I mean, it's a very secretive environment, obviously, but I got really invested in that. I thought it was going to be just a writing project. And then it was like, you've been in interest, like areas that aren't like first world affluent, like, you know, European culture. You go into some places and it's just like supernatural stuff is not like, and this started like clicking with me. It's like, it's not fake. Right. It's like, you might not believe in it, but it really impacts people's lives. And yep. people like believed that they were witches.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, what does it mean if a person believes it and they do everything as though they are this thing? And I started thinking about, you know, Carl Jung.
They are witches.
I'm like, what does that mean? It's like, I can sit back in my, like, you know, suburban context and be like, oh, there's no such thing as witches. They're just superstitious. But it's like, man, people like freaking die. Like, it's like people die and do terrible things, like, in the name of this stuff. So anyway, I started, like, you discover that. And that started, that really, like, that has always stuck with me. I tell people, there was like a 5-year period of time where I was like, I dove into that. And it's like, I'm haunted by that to this day. I mean, this is my early 20s and I'm haunted by that to this day. It sticks with me as a, yeah. I am a pastor at this point, but like it still sticks with me. So anyways, I decided I was going to study religion. I think in the back of my head, I was like, well, you know, maybe I can use the stuff that I learned. But for some reason I decided to choose Christian tradition as my area of focus and study. Hmm. Again, like it just was provoked in me. I decided I was going to do that. So I end up going in. I'm like in my late 20s, mid to late 20s. And so like, I'm totally like way older than everybody in my classes, right? But it just so happened that there was this professor who had just graduated from Princeton Theological Seminary. It was his first year. And he wasn't much older than me, but we really kind of hit it off and connected. And I took a survey of the first 1,000 years of Christian history. My immediate reaction to the first 1,000 years of Christian history was like, yeah, these guys were a bunch of assholes, man. Like, you know, you read about Athanasius and the things that he was doing to Arius. You're just like, man, you're feeling bad for Arius. I'm like, I can't believe this crap. I'm like, yeah, no wonder I got out of this thing. But then it's like, I can remember reading Origen's Contra Celsus, or Celsus, however you want to say it. And realizing that, like, I thought like Christians were just like kind of like ignorant bumpkins who just didn't understand how the world worked, basically, and they had just like selectively like imposed their convictions through power, basically. I had this narrative in my mind because I had also read a lot of like critical theorists and things like that up to this point, anything that would allow me to deconstruct Christian faith. I got to this point where I was like, I read Origin and I read First Principles and I'm like, wow, this guy's actually pretty sophisticated. Like, he's got answers to things that I thought, like, he addresses these questions or, you know, comments that I have, because Celsus in some ways was like an ancient Nietzsche, right? It's like, you know, he was like, he had some pretty like damning criticisms of Christianity where it's like, he's not criticizing the truthfulness necessarily of it. He's saying, even if it's true, it's like, this is bunk. Like, this is, this guy, Jesus, is not worth worshiping. That's basically his argument, right? He's like, I'll concede that Jesus exists. He's like, he's not worth worshiping. And it's kind of like, that's why Nietzsche's Antichrist is still like, I mean, you don't, I don't have an answer to that book. It's like, you either think that Jesus was this kind of like lazy hedonist, or you think that there was something good about him laying down his life. It's like, you know, anyway. But so I got into that. And I was like, wow, there's actually some stuff that's actually really sophisticated here that I haven't been able to wrap my mind around.
Hang on one second. I got to get this knock because I think someone just got out of the hospital.
Uh-oh. Okay. You have a lot of it. I forget where I was. But I was, Celsus.
Country Celsus.
I started reading then into, you know, started reading a bunch of other stuff too. It's like, part of what this guy from PTS suggested that I read, he's like, he had me read Augustine's Confessions, which, or Augustine, however you want to say it. I'd never read that before. And I was like, whoa. Again, like, then I started reading more Augustine. And I was like, oh, this guy was really smart too. What in the world? And his comments about Genesis. And I'm like, I thought I had debunked Genesis as, you know, just kind of like fable or whatever. Sorry, I've got my train coming by here. It might get loud in a second.
That's all right.
I was like, wow, he's got some really like thoughtful responses to that kind of thing. I also found Origen's comments about the spiritual reading of scripture to be really compelling to me. It was like something I had never heard before. It was God's literal word. And it's like literal meant kind of historical, except when it came to Song of Songs, and we didn't really talk about that. and so read Gregory Nyssa, read all the Cappadocians, and then also read the Epistle to the Romans. Just my teacher said, just sit down and read it in one sitting.
Yep.
And I was like, I had already been kind of into Soren Kierkegaard years before. I was like, wow, there's some really interesting ways of looking at, you know, the binding of Isaac and all that, when I didn't care about any of it. And I read Romans, I'm like, wow, this is the guy who inspired Soren Kierkegaard's writing style.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, he's actually really intelligent, like Paul is. It's like, he's not just like, you know, this is the Bible. It's like, wow, this is a pretty interesting way about going about an argument. And so read that. Then I wanted to read Galatians and all of his letters, right? And he also had a really interesting approach to the Old Testament, which I had never heard before, which I thought I had never heard before, where it's like, you know, all this stuff is signs of what's happening. And, you know, like Abraham, Sarah, these are signs of Christ and all these kinds of things. Then you read Hebrews. And to me, it's like Hebrews is the most important book in the whole New Testament to read if you're trying to get kind of like a handle on Christian hermeneutics, right? It's like, mm-hmm. What's the lens by which we read scripture? It's like, oh, you get a sense for that in Hebrews. And I just had never even thought of it before. I'd always been like under the impression that, you know, Jesus was just this like teddy bear that we all held in love. And the Old Testament's like, sorry, that's just how it is. And you get to go, we got to go to war. And I was always really not compelled by either of those images of you know, God or of Jesus, because Jesus to me was always like the hardest thing to access in the Bible in a lot of ways. He felt like David Bowie's character and the man who fell to earth. He was like a space alien. Like, and so I never understood this, you know, Jesus as like, you know, oh, hey, it makes me feel so good. Right. But so I started having the lid kind of thrown off of like my way of understanding the Bible. And so all of a sudden now I was like reading it again with like a fresh set of eyes. It's like I'm reading like the Gospel of John. And I'm like, is Jesus being sarcastic right here? That's what it like kind of feels like. And that exchange between him and Pilate about what is truth is really like, I don't know, just very, it felt like a modern author had written this thing. It was like so resonant for me. So really started diving into that. And this was at a state university, a public university. It's at Arizona State University. I had this experience. And then the next thing that happened, I started studying deeply like the historical, you know, historical critical approach and the criticisms that are leveled against Christianity and what they're based on. And I'd always just been under this assumption that like, these are really like airtight arguments that these people are providing. And then you realize it's just not. And I knew enough about Navajo and religious tradition to know that probably most religious traditions are grounded in oral history first, before they were actually written down. So a lot of criticisms I'm reading about have to do with like when we're finding manuscripts, the errors in manuscripts. It's like, you know, Bart Ehrman and his arguments are like the least compelling thing for me on the planet at this juncture, because I'm like, you know, everything that we have in the Bible is probably like inspired by something oral that is so freaking old that we can't even like get our minds around, actually. And so it's like the documentary hypothesis, they have these, you know, fairly cogent arguments for why Moses didn't write it. But it's like, unless you think that this was all grounded in something that's oral, that's much older than the written documents that we have, right? So what does it mean to write something, you know? It's like, then you get into the question of how authorship is actually shaped and formed. And I read an introduction to a commentary on Ephesians where this guy just like shoots down all these criticisms about Paul is not the author of that text. And I was like, all the arguments made a lot of sense to me. I was like, oh yeah, that's a really good point. It's like, what if he had like, you know, different scribes and all this kind of stuff? It's like, it throws the questions into question pretty summarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so that started happening to me at ASU. And then during that time, I had professors suggest to me, hey, you should go to graduate school. That had not been on my radar at all. I was like, I don't want to do that. And then I read, I wasn't even sure how I would go about doing that. And then I started reading more theology, started reading, some older guys like John Calvin's Institutes. And I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive. And then I also read some modern guys. I don't know if you're familiar with Ephraim Radner. He's out of Wycliffe College. He wrote a book on called The End of the Church, which is just a really fascinating historical read of like pneumatology, right? The movements of the Holy Spirit and what the implications are given what we've seen in our fractured church in the modern world. Huh. His conclusion he basically comes to is that if we are the body of Christ, as the Bible indicates, it's like maybe we are recreating Christ's march up to Calvary, and we have to be broken and bruised on our way up to that. The scary thing, he says, is that means maybe the greatest testimony that the church can give to the world is by actually dying. And so that's why he has this thesis about the end of the church. Anyway, so I read that, and that kind of blew my mind a little bit. And so I was like, well, I'd love to study theology more. And so I was like, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to like apply to all the best programs in the country, the best.
Yeah. Right? What are the best?
Yeah, exactly. I was just ignoramus really, but I started doing these, you know, what you do, Google searches, what are the best schools study theology at? And so it was like the list, the consistent ones were always Harvard, Yale, Duke, and Princeton Theological Seminary. And so I was like, well, I'll apply to all of those. And if I don't get into any of them, which I probably won't, then I don't have to worry about any of this stuff. And I can also tell my professors that I tried. And so I applied to all of them, blah, blah, blah. And then I got into all of them. And I was
getting into Yale Divinity is different from getting into Yale Law.
Yeah, yeah.
Real different.
Yeah, real difference. And once you get there, you discover there's a real difference. I was like, anyway, but I got into all of them. Yale Divinity offered me a full ride. And so I was like, well, I got to do that. I'd be stupid not to. And
I turned down money.
Yeah, exactly. And so I go there. I work for their, and they give me a job working at their Beinecke Rare Books Manuscripts Library. So I go,
that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it was great. Oh, it was great. I got to hold a Luther Bible that was like from, the 16th century. It was really cool. Worked out there. My thesis reader was Miroslav Volf.
Oh, wow.
I was out there, developed a really good relationship with Catherine Tanner. Some really great folks got exposed to, but out there. So going out there though, I thought I was liberal going out there. I put religion not decided or something like that on my entry form. And I go out there thinking I was liberal, and they were just replacing the gender signs on the restrooms because the previous graduating class had ripped them all down as being like bigoted at the time. And I was like, and the administration was too scared to, because everybody in the administration was really uncomfortable, I think, with like not sharing bathrooms with everybody, but they've been. And so I come out there, and that's kind of what I step into. I'm out there in 2000. I'm out there during the Halloween costume thing. And actually, I lived in a house with seven other people, and I had people who were actually, I had a guy who was a family friend with the Christakises in the house, but I also had a person in the house who was involved with BLM organization, who was actually making demands of the administration regarding, like, you know, their perceived mistreatment in this moment, right? And so I was out there for that. Was down in the yard when all the yelling and screaming was happening. That was made so much news. And I was like, man, what is going on? Like, I was just baffled. And then I started taking, like, you know, I started taking some of the seminars, and a lot of them were really good. Some of the old school people that you have working there are just like really, really intelligent. There's a guy named John Hare there who is just like, yeah, really thoughtful theologian. And obviously Miroslav and Kathy are both like really thoughtful too. Started reading, you know, Schleiermacher and all these kinds of things. But then we got into like James Cone and to Mary Daly and to, like, you know, all these kinds of like into Lynn Tonstadt, she was also up there. So we got into hard into like queer theology. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff like that going around. James Cone came up and spoke at the Divinity School before he passed away. It was the first sermon I ever heard where somebody actually quoted the Gospel of Thomas in their sermon. during that time, I started like getting the sense that, like, oh, maybe I'm not liberal because I'm not like any of this at all.
And
I'm in my late 20s, so I'm a little older than some folks, but at YDS, there's actually like a lot of second career people there.
I can imagine.
But everybody around campus was very pretty radical. And then the stuff with Trump started happening. I don't watch the news. Like, I haven't watched the news. Like, I will get snapshots of it like once a week. But I remember I read somewhere that, like, you know, the Solzhenitsyn quote about you have a right to be informed, but you also have a right not to be informed. And it's like, oh yeah, that seems really smart actually. And I also, like, I've always had a punk rock suspicion of media and its total. And so, but then like stuff with Trump started happening and all my housemates wanted to watch the Republican debates, which I thought was really super weird. And then I'm watching it and I'm just like, oh my gosh, I'm hearing all the guy's stuff he's saying. I couldn't believe it. And then they're all like laughing at this goon. And I'm like thinking about people. Cause I've been working blue collar work. I had been a janitor while I was working in screenwriting. I had worked in parks departments. I had lived in like blue collar America where, you know, the drug problem was just starting in the late 80s and like only escalated. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, listen to this guy. And I just felt this guy's going to win. I remember saying it at some point, like to him, I'm like, this guy's going to win. You guys like are laughing at him, but he's going to win. And I remember somebody looked at me and like, Eric, I think sometimes you just like to watch the world burn. And I was like, no, man, I'm just like this guy. I think there's a good chance. They did a survey of students while I was there. You know, they said like 99% of students said that Hillary was going to win. The other 1% said that they were voting for Jill Stein and Gary Johnson. And then the election night happened. Like they had the debates, by the way, they had like Super Bowl parties at like the bars around town. Like there were people watching the debates, drinking and laughing at Trump all the time. I can remember going down to the basement of this one of these bars and seeing one of my classmates sitting there by himself watching the TV with the sound off and just reading the captions. And he's like, you know, if you're away from all the laughter, he says, they both don't sound that different. Like, it's like, it just, all that up there makes him sound comedic and implausible. But it's like, if you just are sitting here, it's kind of plausible. And it was like, that was an interesting moment. During this time too, obviously stuff with Jordan Peterson came up. And I remember in, I think it was 2016, the fall of 2016, that was going on. So I started getting more invested in what was going on in the Jordan Peterson world when that video, like to me, what was interesting was like, oh, there's this professor who's being outspoken about transgender stuff. And I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting. Cause I was also part of my program, I was studying liturgy and like YouTube culture and stuff like that. And so I started getting kind of like, that's how I kind of discovered him. And I was like, wow, that's pretty cool that he's being bold enough to say something like that. And I even emailed him at some point and said, hey, I just wanted to let you know that you've really, you know, you really inspired me. And yeah, you've at least one friend out there at Yale. And, you know, he thanked me and said, you should read Carl Jung. And I was like, okay, thank you. And then it was like, you know, the election happened and they canceled classes. People were crying in the streets, like literally crying. There was a teacher who got up and he read Lamentations in tears. He read Lamentations to class after Trump got elected. And it was just like, it was such a
Babylonians have destroyed the temple.
Yeah, that's kind of how it felt, right? It's like you couldn't even like, I couldn't even wrap my mind around what I was seeing. Like I hadn't been like a Trump supporter or anything like that, but I'm sitting here and I'm like, not that there, hey everybody, if anybody ever watches this besides you, not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's like I'm sitting there and I'm like, what is happening? What, like, these are like adults. And I feel maybe bad saying that, but it's like, that was my reaction. I was like, somebody told me that, you know, about the experience they had had that day, about all the tears that they experienced. And I was like, that's just like so sad that like, and like pathetic that like, that's where people are emotionally, right?
Talk about fragile.
Yeah, yeah. I just was like so flabbergasted. And so, you know, that was 2016 and things kind of like, you know, escalated from there a little bit. It was like, I don't know, people like tension kind of arose and I began to realize more and more that I'm actually pretty like, you know, I'm really suspicious of politics, but theologically, you know, as a Christian, I am a Christian. And by the way, I'm also really pretty conservative about my Christianity because like the other thing that I started realizing while I was out there, and you probably have some familiarity with this, is like the perspective that says that like, basically you start trying to over accommodate the religion to culture. I mean, religions function like language. And so if you try to accommodate the religious language too much to this other cultural language, it's like pretty soon the religious language kind of gets like subsumed in that and it stops like having any meaningful content to it.
That's right.
Words are just metaphors that we're using to get at the abstraction, right? And if the word isn't useful for getting at that abstraction anymore, it's like it ceases to be the thing anymore, right?
Right.
It's like, anyway, so I realized at some point that you had to have a strong commitment to the language of your religious system. Otherwise, you might as well just discard the whole entire thing. And I hadn't seen any credible arguments to me for discarding that thing.
Yep.
Because the alternative to focusing in on and committing to your religious language system was like, complete fragmentation and unknowing.
Yeah.
Like is what I was experiencing, especially after the election. I was just kind of like, this is what you get. This is the foundation. This is your foundation. It's like you are experiencing collective cognitive dissonance right now because your religious system has failed you.
Yes.
I remember I heard a Lutheran minister say his experience of it was as if somebody found Jesus's bones. It was like that like Hillary losing was like as if somebody had found Jesus's bones. And I was like, oh, that's really an interesting way of thinking about this. And then I read Eric Voegelin, I think. He made this connection between Gnosticism and some of the political movements that he saw manifesting in the late 70s. And that kind of drew some connections to me as well as like, really, we're talking about counter religions right now. And so I'm gonna pick the religion that I'm gonna commit to. I'm really gonna press into that. And so all that happened. I graduate. I don't want to go through the PhD stuff because I'm just like I'm kind of over academia at this point. And I get a job at Arizona State University teaching, and also over at there's a university out here called Grand Canyon University. I get a job there teaching. And so I come back out to the Phoenix area to do that. I know during this whole time, Paul, I haven't had a church that I called home. I knew that I had to get into a church though. First thing I needed to do is get into a church, because if you don't build a church into your rhythm, it's really easy. I mean, we're discovering this now in the wake of COVID. It's really easy to cancel church out of your rhythm.
Yep.
Right? And so I immediately started looking for churches. eventually I stumble into this local church right down the street from me that's meeting at a performing arts studio in our old town area out in Peoria. Turns out that the pastors there have very similar background to me, and in terms of like being involved with music and kind of like, you know, deconstructing, right? Luckily they reconstructed in the way that I, you know, I reconstructed as well. They were really something that I really became committed to while I was out at Yale was the importance of church calendar and liturgy. I think it's really unfortunate that we've lost some of that. They were really committed to that as well and really hit it off. It was really kind of like just fortuitous. And so I started going to this church. Me and the pastor would have a series of lively discussions before I actually became a minister. And I discovered during this time that there were Mennonite brethren, Anabaptist tradition. Obviously, I didn't come from that. We would get into theological debates. And my dad was a lawyer, so I became very comfortable as a child getting into debates and discussions. I just remember though leaving one of our discussions and the pastor stops in the parking lot, turns around and says, "Hey, I just want to make sure that you're not going to leave the church over this." And I remember like, this probably was not the appropriate answer, but I laughed out loud when he said that. And I was like, no. And I was just so like, I found that to be so like, I don't know. There was something so great about that. I just loved that even though we had this disagreement, he still wanted me to be part of the church.
Yeah.
And so that was when I decided like, I'm committed here. And, you know, as I was teaching, I was getting more involved in, you know, in volunteering and serving at the church. At some point, the pastor approaches me and asks me, says, "Hey, I'm sensing the pastor's heart in you. Is that something that you would consider?" And we kind of entered into that process. I went through, you know, all the, you know, the process with the denomination, the Mennonite Brethren, and got licensed with them. And I'm only, I'm still bivocational. I'm still teaching over at the universities. But I'm also now this Mennonite Brethren pastor, which has been kind of like a weird journey in and of itself. I mean, we're not like, we don't have like big beards and ride horses and buggies or anything like that. We're like a really hipster church. We came into this old town area. We revitalized a lumber yard and we have a coffee shop attached to our church, right? We get like, we don't call ourselves, our building's not a church. It's a venue space, right? And a church meets there.
Oh, you're such a church planter.
Yeah, so totally, right? And I moved down the alley from the church, so I can see the church building from my house. Really, because I really believed in like the importance of local and being kind of connected to a local body and people in a community, because something that just really always exhausted me about kind of the evangelical project, it seemed like people were commuting 45 minutes to go to church. And it's like, man, how much of life are you not doing with people in your community, yeah, right? And that's why it's like, to me, it's like, that's what creates the consumer, right? It's like, yep, the church consumer is, it's just another thing that you do,
yeah,
right? Like going to Walmart or whatever, or yeah, actually after COVID, we discovered that Walmart's actually more essential than the church. So,
or the strip clubs in California.
Yeah. 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 And so I've been pastor of our community groups specifically. But I was out here, you know, obviously during COVID, and I can remember being like, this was like a hard year and a half to be a pastor. I was, yeah, in Arizona. I wasn't even in California, and I can, yeah, say that. And I just remember, I'm not anti, you know, I think COVID is real. I'm not one of these people, but I remember sitting with my elders and really resisting closing our doors.
Yeah.
Because I just said, you know, it takes about 3 weeks to establish a new rhythm in one's life.
Yeah.
And then it'll take something like COVID to disrupt that, yeah, new rhythm. Yeah. And that's why I'm like, hey, we can be really cautious, but it's like, I just don't think we should stop meeting.
Yeah.
We ended up deciding as a team to transition into that and into doing online. Luckily, we were a church with a lot of artists and creative personalities there. We had people who had live stream equipment. And so our church is only about like 100, 150 people, but we were able to put together what I thought was actually pretty like, well, within a week, we were able to put together our live stream kind of like system and operated really well. We were able to maintain community surprisingly. throughout COVID. We really emphasized small groups during that time. But it was like, oh God, it was just like so painful. I don't think like dark, you know, it's like, I didn't realize what dark night was until, you know, you're just like sitting in your house by yourself. Like, cause you know, you can't go. And it's like, I remember it being Easter and just like, we're recording our live stream and there's just like nobody else there. And I just remember looking out the window and just being like, this is Easter morning. And it's just like, it just feels like any other morning right now.
Yeah.
It was like so tough in a lot of ways. We made it through. I think overall our church really responded well to the moment, but it did leave a lot of, I still have lingering question marks in the wake of that.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, I don't think that this goes away. I think a door of possibility has been opened in the way that school shooting became a thing after Columbine. Nobody thought that was possible. Then it happens and it becomes possible.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, we live in this kind of like theater of medical and media. And it's like, right now it's like, we're all just kind of playing our parts in it. And I really do think that, I think that this is going to be a perennial kind of issue that the church has to deal with, shutting its doors. That's my perception. But then, you know, being out there, I found in my heart a desire to be a church planter still, or a replanter, one of the two. Because I find something really, I think there's going to be a lot of communities dying around the country. And
yeah,
I find them.
Yeah. A lot of churches are going to die.
Yeah. And I feel there's like, there's a call to just like try to save and salvage too. So anyway, I've been just talking so much.
That's been great. I love your story. It's a great story. It's so cool.
Thank you, man. I discovered you early on in the process. I think my brother, he's a medical student out in Baylor. He pointed me in your direction pretty early on when you posted that first video. He's like, oh, you might be interested in what this pastor guy has to say. And so I'm not involved in social media. So I'm not like, I wasn't like leaving comments for you or, you know, all this kind of stuff. But it's like, I've been following you since probably, you know, that first video.
Holy cow.
Really kind of got off the ground.
Oh, gee.
You were held by the way that you engage with people. And in fact, I've had students come up to me who have started coming back to their faith through Jordan Peterson, but then started realizing that there was like, Jordan Peterson's not Orthodox. And he's actually kind of like heretical in a lot of ways is how they would describe it to me. He's like, and they're like, we notice that a lot of the language you use is kind of similar to what he says. You talk about archetypes a lot and Carl Jung. It's like, what are your thoughts about Jordan Peterson? So we would talk and then I would always point them in your direction. I'd be like, you should watch this pastor, Paul Vanderclay. And so, I've been aware and paying attention to you. I mean, beyond being a really good pastor, I mean, I'm not trying to toot your horn or anything like that. It's just like the level of reading and like thoughtfulness, like you give to things is just like remarkable to me. You strike me. I've told my brother, I have told him this. I'm like, man, just based on what I've seen from you on YouTube, I'm like, you're the kind of pastor that pastors should aspire to be. it's like, you know, being in the kind of context that you've described being in, I'm just so compelled by that. Dedicating your life to that kind of service and then finding a new area that needed ministering to and just seeking that out. So just, yeah, really compelled by that, man.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It kind of grew. I don't know. It's, you know, my church is small and dying. And so I want to be faithful to these people. I don't think the church is going to somehow balloon because of, you know, my online ministry, because churches are very local. They're very local and very individual. They're like fingerprints. They're very organic and they're authentic. And people take a look at this particular organic and authentic and like, why would I want to be a part of that? It's too organic and authentic. Because what people are, they hear organic and authentic. What they really want is mirroring. Oh, I want the church to, want the church to be a flattering mirror to.
They want all the good and none of the bad. They don't want any of the garbage.
Yeah.
That's not like, for me, it's like, we're in an inner city kind of area where our church is at. And I was like all in. So I bought a house out here. And I thought everybody in the church is going to start doing that.
Yeah,
and then no. And you're like, nobody's going to do that.
No. There's real reasons they're not going to do it.
Yeah.
And God bless them. And that's why, you know, there's people are in at different levels and they partner at different levels. And churches are sort of, you know, a consensus develops that this is what people are able to give and able to do. And so it kind of is that way. So now I've been tremendously blessed. I had no idea what was going to happen after I made those first couple of videos about Jordan Peterson, but the whole journey has been fruitful and deeply gratifying and just a lot of fun, So
yeah, you look like you're having fun, man.
I'm having a great time.
I just love your spirit and energy on the, can I use that language, spirit and energy?
He certainly may. That's totally fine.
I'm just kidding. I've also been like, so I emailed you several months ago because you had Andy Littleton on.
And
I've
actually
entered into a good dialogue with Andy.
Oh, good.
From me. Since that time, you started entering into this conversation about powers and principalities.
Yeah.
That I've just like, that to me is like, from a Christian leader's perspective, it's like, that's the thing that every pastor should be talking about. Yeah. Paul, like, this has been like spiritual warfare, like nuts, like this last year and a half. Yeah. Probably before that, it's just become more evident, right? I remember at the beginning of COVID, all of a sudden, I was getting called to houses to do like exorcism, not exorcisms, to pray over a house because people were sensing that there was bad spirits in the house.
Yeah.
And all these kinds of things. And I've also studied enough about Greco-Roman kind of perceptions of the demons and spirits to know like, it's not like there's like a guy who's standing there and he's like, I'm a devil and I'm going to get you. It's like the things that we call emotions are very similar to what people are talking about when they're talking about possession and spirits.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I would love to hear like, what has been kind of like, what has led you to like locate that as like this kind of like dominant theme, like something worth like really emphasizing and focusing on? Is there, I mean, that's kind of a big question in some ways, but I'm just like, I'm so compelled by your language of using that, of recognizing. You said at one point, you said that these videos and these books are colonizing your mind. And I was like, yeah, that's like all we are doing now. We're in a culture of colonizing. We're cannibalizing one another on a spiritual level. We're participating in this warfare and we don't even realize it. Yeah. So I don't know if there's something for you to answer there.
Well, so James K. Smith, you probably heard of him. He's at Calvin University now. I mean, he's written a series of books on secular liturgy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it struck me. So part of what grabbed my attention about Jordan Peterson was, and I think this sort of also comes through Jung, is the disconnect in our language around spirit. It's quite frankly, in modernity, amazing that, hang on a second, I'll be right back.
All right.
So this, you know, this word spiritual remains in our language and people use it all the time. And even highly secular, you know, people who are, you know, hard-bitten new atheist type continue to use it. And it's like, you ever stop and ask yourself what you mean by that word? And I got into this because I do Bible studies at church and people, in churches like this, you'll tend to collect people who are committed Christians, but they, you know, they haven't necessarily thought they've got, you know, good Christian practice, but they haven't necessarily thought terribly deeply about all of the Western evangelical language kitsch that they've just picked up along the way. And part of the way that you gain status in a church like this is you learn to master that kitschy language. And so you have all this code talk that goes around. And at some point, you know, and I don't want to be a jerk about it, but at some point as a pastor, it's like, well, maybe we should start to play around with some of this kitschy code talk and see if we can get under it a little bit, because there's just a fair amount of social bullshittery that is going on with all this kitschy code talk. So, and so then someone would say something like salvation, and I would say, well, what do you mean by that? And then of course it'd be like, oh crap, why does he do this to me? I'm in front of my good church friends and he's asking me a question I can't answer about a word we're all using. It's like, all right, but I'll be gentle and I'm not going to leave you on the hook here, but we're just going to poke around there a little bit and say, what do you mean by that word salvation? What do you mean by kingdom of God? And then what do you mean by spiritual? And of course, people have no idea. And so I was wrestling with that stuff and, you know, reading a lot of C.S. Lewis. And then, of course, Jordan Peterson came along, and the way that he, the breadth of people that he sort of got a hold of, and some of the particular groups of those people who had sort of deconstructed into, you know, hard-bitten modernistic rationality like new atheists, or into sort of mushy new age spiritualism. And these are the people that he sort of, at least some of those people, he sort of got their attention. And then they start, similar to your story, they want to do things like read Origen or Church Fathers. And I thought, now this, and the breadth of this movement, I thought, this is to me, I immediately saw, this is one of the more significant movements that I've seen in terms of my adult North American ministry. I'll say it that way. You know, I had seen the seeker movement. I kind of came back to North America as that was sort of receding. I'd done my junkets to Willow Creek, to Saddleback. I'd taken a good look at that. It was never going to be applicable at a church like this. We're just never going to be able to pull off the music and the sound and the image and the excellence. It's just never going to fly in this place. It's way too ragtag, way too much authenticity. And I'd watched the emergent movement sort of split into young, restless, and reformed. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting, because I'd been, you know, I'd grown up in a reformed tradition, but this was obviously sort of similar to some of the hardcore Dutch Reformed, but much more Presbyterian. And then, of course, the Rob Bell and that whole thing on Oprah. And so watching those two things coming out of the emergent movement, and it's like, okay, what's going to come next down the road? And then I church plant. So we had been planting churches pretty aggressively when I got here in the late 90s, early aughts. And my partner, who's the pastor of another CRC church, who had one of the few successful CRC church planters using, say, a seeker methodology. I mean, he actually grew up in Kalamazoo, and he used to cut the grass for Bill Hybels' mom in Kalamazoo. That was his job in high school, you know, cutting Bill Hybels' mom's grass. So he was, you know, he's a good pastor and very...
Well, be careful. That almost sounds like something else.
yeah. Very refined. And so he had actually been fairly successful, especially in CRC terms. I mean, he'd grown a church into 300-400 people in suburban Sacramento. And so we both got into church planting. And then right away, like the second church, the first church plant out of the box, these guys wanted to do a cell model. That was interesting. The third church was more of a seeker church again. And then the fourth church plant wanted more of a Tim Keller PCA type thing. And then by the fifth church plant, it was all liturgy and, you know, weekly Eucharist and using that word and liturgical seasons, and then these other church plants all started going that way too. And I thought, well, this is interesting. Now, of course, Livingstones can't ride any of those bandwagons. I mean, this church it just can't do a bandwagon. It's just way too authentic. Not, you know, just, you can't turn this church. It just is what it is. So, you know, I'm watching all of this stuff happen. Then, of course, Jordan Peterson comes through and I see all of these people interested in orthodoxy, and Peugeot comes on the scene, and it's like, there's stuff about this and stuff behind this. And I had, you know, I had visited Redeemer in New York City and, you know, had a quiet little seminar with Tim Keller, with a couple of our, with some of our Sacramento church planters. We'd had an in sort of, so we had a sort of a private audience and a chance to take a poke around Redeemer Press fairly closely. And, you know, that was in some ways closest to where I was from, because Keller comes out of Westminster East, and in the 80s, there was this whole urban missions thing that was happening.
Yeah.
A lot of it out of Westminster East. So, you know, the Keller stuff was pretty close to me, but, you know, we were never going to be anything like a kind of reformed conservative cathedral church, which is sort of what Tim Keller was doing. And then of course, Jordan Peterson comes along, and I thought, it's enough in alignment with the, you know, the ancient worship theme that had really developing out of the emergent thing. And it was, he was provoking a lot of deeper questions that were really getting at secularity. And then of course I made a video and people started watching it and contacting me, and that was completely unexpected. You know, I'd been working in this church 20 years, and you know, I'm known in my denomination, but beyond it, you know, I don't have a mega church. I'm not on the cover of Christianity Today. So then, well, what do we mean by this word spiritual? And of course, Jung, I didn't know anything about Jung, but totally different take on things. So I had to get up at speed on some of that stuff. And then, you know, back to philosophy. And you begin to realize that this phenomenologically is not a, it's not a bad approach to this, which is of course very much the way Peugeot went. It's post Heidegger. And you know, then of course someone pointed me to John Vervaeke, developed a relationship with him. So you begin to, so when in churches, especially a tradition like the CRC, which wasn't Pentecostal, but could be Pentecostal friendly, charismatic friendly. I went in Grand Rapids and in college, I was in sort of a charismatic Christian Reformed urban church, which sort of tied a lot of those strands together for me. And just knowing that this word spiritual, we're going to have a far deeper understanding of it. And by virtue of my Dutch Calvinist tradition, you neither can exclude sort of the supernatural that you would bump in. And of course, you know, Black urban America where I grew up, and then Haitians in the Dominican Republic, and then charismatic, reformed, you know. So I wasn't a skeptic about what modernists would call the supernatural. But it's also got to tie into a secular culture.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in terms of my videos, I just sort of follow where the conversation leads. And so I really had to, you know, I've been really thinking about, okay, what do we mean by this word? And how does that connect? So this week I'm preaching on Paul. He's leaving Antioch after he and Barnabas are there for a year. And then he's going to Cyprus. And basically, you've got a showdown between this Jewish magician, Bar Jesus, versus Paul. And Paul, you know, basically curses him and says, "You're going to be blind for a while." And the guy turns blind. And this is all in front of the proconsul, who is watching this. And he's like, all right, well, that Paul and he got credibility, he's got my attention, and and there's sort of an easy dismissal by secularist modernists of this stuff as this is legend, this is all BS. But you know, like you, if you're around Navajo for a while, it's like, this isn't BS. You know, there's a reality to this. But if you've been around enough Pentecostals, you know, they got some BS going on there too sometimes. And the prophets roll into town and the show comes in and it's like, there's a good bit of skepticism about that too. So you really want to somehow bring all of this together into an integrated picture where spiritual doesn't simply deny sort of a modernist frame, because people are going to have to integrate this into their worldview as they leave secularism.
Yeah.
So you're not gonna deny what modernists feel like spooky powers, but you're also going to have to integrate this into what Trump did, because that was, you know, however you feel about his politics, well, he sort of gave the nation an advanced course in an exorcism of sorts. You know, that'd be one frame to think about what happened with Trump. Yeah. And I loved what you said. It's as if someone discovered Jesus' bones. And so I want to figure this out. And my channel for me is a lot of figuring things out. And if you're going to silo yourself in, which we sort of see probably, I don't want to speak ill of these people, I don't know them, but in a place like, let's say, Yale Divinity, maybe I'm just working off an impression, but I see that often, because you have to sort of silo yourself off because the world is too big. And so then the whole key is, well, let's have a productive filter.
Yeah.
So that some things get filtered out, and it's we can work in a manageable level for the church to deeply work on this question of, okay, so the Holy Spirit is moving through your church. And you can approach that language in a fairly modernistic way. You can approach it in a Pentecostal way. You can approach it in sort of a primitive way and try and get at what the Romans were dealing with. But one way or another, we're going to need to use that word in a competent way. And I've found in this little corner of the internet, you know, with, you know, say Peugeot and his Orthodox tribe and Verveke and his non-theist tribe and the Roman Catholics and this whole crazy group that we've sort of gathered together here, I think we're having a productive conversation about this. And that's rare. So let's have it. And again, I see this very much as a spiritual movement, because not only do I believe it's the work of the Holy Spirit working through this, but it's also all of these spiritual streams just kind of coming together. And you know, one of the things I picked up from Tim Keller, which he picked up from one of his seminary profs at Gordon Conwell, was, you know, revival happens, and it's the work of God. You know, you sort of want to try to make an altar on top of Carmel and say, okay, Lord, you know, we're ready for you to show up, but only you can show up. Yes. You know, and in revival, all of the streams come together. And there's, you know, there's new hymnody that erupts. There's fervent prayer. You know, there's pious devotion. There's, you know, work with the poor and poverty and justice. It's all of the things. And the history of Christianity has been in many ways a series of revivals, with often dying of things. I mean, Chesterton notes that, you know, the seven deaths of Christianity. It keeps dying and rising again. And certainly modern Christianity is dying.
Yes.
And that's epitomized in, you know, the mainline church. Now, obviously, these deaths are never full and complete. They're always, you know, somewhat dead or mostly dead, but it never seems to go all the way dead.
Yeah, there's still a little bit of movement in the body.
That's right. But so I saw with the Jordan Peterson thing, I thought, there could be a revival from this. And I think there already has been to a degree, but revivals come and they reshape the world.
Yes.
And I don't want to be sitting on the sidelines when the revival happens. I want to be there.
Yeah. That's, oh man. And that's like, that's the real sense, right? It's like, this last year and a half has made me, I don't know, I felt very impatient, like this last year and a half, for the reason of like, I feel like things have been like ramping up. And now we're getting to this place where it's like, things are changing indelibly. Like you can't, like we can't go back from whatever it is we've just entered into. And I'm gonna be stuck at home. It's like, you know, as a pastor, it's like there are people dying in the hospital and I'm stuck at home. It's like, there's all these things happening right now, and you feel like you can't just be like separated from it. You have to be engaged with it, because you sense this flow happening right now.
Yeah.
I you know, you're talking about John Vervaeke. I want to thank you for introducing me to him as well, in terms of like just his content, so good. But like he talks about shamans as entering into this like flow state, and I'm like thinking like what happens like culturally. Seems like what you're describing is like a kind of like cultural flow state, almost like these revivals and things like that. It's when we're all like just releasing ourselves to this something, right? And that can be really good or it can be really bad, depending on how you're testing that spirit, because it's like, it's a battle right now.
Yeah.
It's not evident to me that like good spirit is like rising up over like bad spirit.
Yeah.
And we've all seen, you know, people who listen to Jordan Peterson, you know about like instances where bad spirit has taken over and possessed a society. It can happen, right?
Yeah.
How do you find good spirit? And we're like an Anabaptist tradition out here, so we're really emphasizing like third way stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, people who are liberal churches out here say that we're conservative and too reformed. They think that we're reformed. I think what they mean is they just remind them of like, you know, Tim Keller or something.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, the conservative churches think that we're liberal. And in a lot of ways, like, I actually think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But we have increasingly, like, out in the Phoenix area, we're having churches like getting really divided over lots of issues.
Yeah.
And right now, there was actually a church that got on and said, like, the pastor gave a sermon, local church, and he goes, anybody who says that they're third way, that's a euphemism for like, you know, lukewarm. It's like, it's basically, you're either with us or you're against us, is what this pastor is saying. And he's talking specifically about social justice issues.
Yeah. I hear like, that a lot.
And you know, you were talking about the Young, Restless, and Reformed. We got Mark Driscoll and his church out here. They actually, I've got people who go to that church. They've grown by 300% since COVID. it's like there's this weird tension even within the body of the church, not even like just culture broadly. Obviously it's there, but there's a book called Broken Church, Broken Nation. It's a little volume. I don't know if you ever read that, but this guy, it's a short historical study of the breakdown of major national denominations in the United States in the decades prefiguring the Civil War. And how actually these denominational divisions kind of exactly paralleled like what happened within the country itself. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting thinking about that perspective of what's happening now. It's like, okay, what is being born right now, right? Because I do think that the church, the spiritualism of a country is reflective of where the country is going to materially be at.
Yeah.
In fact.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff happening there. I think like your language, like Mormonism, I grew up around Mormonism. So knowing Mormon history, reading, I don't know if you've read D. Michael Quinn, he wrote a book called Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. If you are a fan of history, like he is like a king historian.
What's his name? D. Michael Quinn.
D. Michael Quinn, Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview. He's like talking about like pointing out how these revivalists that Mormonism was grounded in, the things that they're seeing through spiritual eyes, that there's this kind of strange, like, in the wake of and leading up to these kinds of like revivals, people stop seeing just what we're seeing materially, right?
Right.
Earth seeing things of spirit. And I think that like, that's really been helpful for me to consider and think through too. He looks at like things like sales records for like books on magic in the United States, and how there were actually more people buying these books on astrology and magic than there were people buying Bibles in the United States leading up to. And it's like, what does that mean? And I'm like, then you start thinking about like astrology is becoming popular in the United States again, but also for the last 2 decades, we've all been looking into these scryer stones, right? These like crystal balls, essentially, looking in. And I think of Gandalf, he had a comment where he said, you know, about the lost seer stones, you look in, you don't know what looks back out into you. Yeah. Or in Nietzsche's terms, you know, you stare into the abyss looks back out into you. It's like, we're looking in right now. We're engaging this technology as we see it.
Yeah.
Functionally, it behaves a lot like magic devices did, yeah. You know, or were seen as doing. So what spirits are coming out through to you in these crystal balls that we're looking into, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, you like C.S. Lewis, Abolition of Man, he does that really quick connection between alchemy and science and alchemy and magic. And it's like magicians and scientists aren't that far apart. It's like they're both trying to harness the power of the earth, yeah. Right? to man's benefit.
Yeah.
It's like, and actually historically they have that connection.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So that stuff's been really, that draws that to my mind as you're talking about kind of this like bubbling, fermenting something that's happening. I've also been, Philip Reef has become very popular again.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And especially in your reform world, Carl Truman, conservative reform guy, he used to be cool in reform circles, and now he's cool in all evangelical circles
because he wrote,
you know, a little book about identity. But he's been drawing people back in Philip Reef, which I think is really useful, because Philip Reef's trilogy on sacred order, social order, is really helpful for also understanding, I think, the deeper battle that's happening, that's underlying this moment, the tensions that are arising. There are these kind of, it's a tension between a one way of perceiving sacredness and this kind of anti-sacredness, which is in a sense its own kind of new system of sacredness.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's got some really interesting insights that he writes about, especially in the crisis of the crisis of the officer class, and My Life Among the Death Works. Those are books that I've been revisiting because he is going off of Deuteronomy and the interdicts that are laid down by God there, and contrasting that to our own moment, essentially.
Interesting.
And so
you're just giving me more books, dude.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I get complaints, and now here you've done it to me. That's what pastors do. It's really bad.
We get alone. We get siloed out here. Nobody else is reading these things except us.
So I know.
We need to talk to somebody.
well, I gotta land the plane here because I gotta do some things. Sorry. But what, you know, is this video good to share? You want to preview it first? What do you think?
I'm comfortable with you sharing it.
Okay. Good. I'd love to. I the conversation before this, I had a lovely talk with a woman who's she's young. She just got married. She's going to the University of Compton studying theology in the Netherlands. And I love these Randall's conversations because it just gives me a chance to step out of my filter and let other things come to me. And so this was just a delight. So I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you giving me this time, Paul.
Send me anything, like if you got church stuff or something that you'd like me to include in this video, you have my email address?
Yeah, I believe so. So just like church website, stuff like that?
Just send it to my name at Gmail. There, I just did it.
Yeah, I'll see. Church. There's been like a closeted like Jordan Peterson community there. They feel afraid about talking about it until they find out that I'm a fan of Jordan Peterson. they'll probably appreciate that. That I'm being public and outspoken about these kinds of things. But I'd be happy to send that to you. And
if you get back to Tucson, have Andy introduce you to my friend Rod.
Yeah, absolutely. You actually connected me with him as well, and I tried to exchange some emails. There's just like so much going on there.
Yeah. But if you're ever down in Tucson, make sure you contact Rod first and say, I want to buy you. If you can get him, if you'd say, I'll buy you breakfast or lunch. I'll take you anywhere you want to go. I'll take you to some Greasy Spoon, and they'll sit and they'll tell you stories. You want to talk about spiritual warfare? Talk to that man.
Oh, love him.
He's a giant in many ways.
Your conversation with him was like, oh, so moving to me.
Oh,
like,
I gotta have him back on the channel.
Oh, so moving. Hopefully I'll be able to sneak in and get another time with you too. Because Paul, I just value your mind and your insight so much.
I hope, you know, Vendonk of course wants to redo the road trip. So I'm sure I'll get down to Arizona again. So, and it'd be much nicer to have lunch with you personally. So
absolutely, man. It'll be on me.
All right. Sounds good.
All right, Paul. Take care.
Yep. Bye-bye.